The Medical AI Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We are Dr. Felix Beecher and Joe McKeating, and we talk to a range of top guests, from scientists to industry innovators to philosophers.
Welcome to the Medical AI Podcast. I'm your host, Joe McKeating. Today, I'm joined by Dr. David Klimstra, the co-founder and chief medical officer at Paige AI. Paige AI is a technology platform designed to enhance pathology practices through the application of artificial intelligence. By leveraging advanced algorithms and vast data sets, Paige AI enhances diagnostic accuracy and efficiency for pathologists, ultimately improving patient outcomes. Dr. Klimstra formerly served as the chair of the pathology department at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City. Dr. Klimstra, thank you for joining me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, in previous interviews, I saw you make an interesting note that at a fundamental level, pathology hadn't advanced in one way in 150 years, meaning from analog to digital, and that the modus operandi was looking at tissue samples, biopsies through a microscope, and that jump to digital, I think you called them whole slide digital images or whole slide digital slides, something like that, was an enormous jump. Would you talk a little bit about that, and how do you see AI comparing in terms of a technological jump like that?
Sure, absolutely. So pathology, which is, you know, the diagnosis of tissue samples, whether from a biopsy or a larger piece of tissue, is traditionally done through a microscope, as you mentioned. And the capability of scanning microscopic slides and creating digital images arose about 15 years ago. But it's been slow to move into practice for a number of very practical reasons. Number one being cost. The scanners are expensive. The storage is expensive. Whole slide images are absolutely enormous. It's among the largest pieces of medical imaging data that exist. And so tooling up to do this is quite a challenge for pathology practice. And so, in the past few years, we've seen an uptick in pathology practices using digital scanning, sometimes not necessarily for the primary diagnosis, but for other applications. But it's been still rather slow to come to the to routine practice, shall we say. You ask about AI. I think one of the ideas was that perhaps by creating efficiency algorithms using AI, we would be able to basically create a return on investment for using the digital platform. But the catch-22 is you can't do AI on pathology images unless you are digital. And so there has to be a critical mass of efficiencies to justify the cost of that transformation.
This may seem obvious, but what was it about the jump to digitization? Why was that so impactful?
Well, I think there are a number of things you can do in the digital environment that you can't do in the analog environment. Some of them are very simple, pragmatic things like instant retrieval of slides that, currently glass slides are heavy, but don't seem like that. But when you make millions of them, they're fragile. They get squirreled away in the basement somewhere, and they're not necessarily easy to find when you need them. A digital image, by contrast, you can pull up from a database instantaneously. You can share digital images instantaneously with colleagues around the world, as opposed to packaging glass slides and mailing them somewhere. And most importantly, once you have the digital images, you can create AI algorithms that not only enhance your diagnostic ability, but have the potential to extract more information from those tissue samples than we currently do today.
And when you were at Memorial Sloan Kettering, am I correct that you kind of led that initiative to digitize the pathology department?
Well, I mean, it was a team. Of course, this was a large initiative, and it started with some colleagues who got into this even before I did many years ago, and grew to about 10 or 15 people who were actively involved in exploring how to do this, working out the operational aspects, justifying the expenses, and building the program of computational pathology that ultimately led to the founding of Paige.
And if you thought back to that time when you and your team start to digitize all of these images, I'm sure it went through your mind at the time, okay, when we create this vast data set, this is going to be useful. Were you thinking AI and machine learning at that time, if you think back to that time? Or how did you think that this would eventually come to fruition in a really impactful way?
Yeah, I think I would have to say yes. I mean, early on, we started digitizing slides for archiving. As I mentioned, you know, you can keep a digital copy that's very easy to retrieve. But, you know, quickly became clear as the archive started to grow that we now had the basis to train machine learning algorithms, which, by the way, require a very large amount of slide data in order to train effectively. And so the idea that we could use this as a research tool was quite apparent early on. The decision to take it into the commercial sector was based on the desire to bring these research models we were building to clinical practice. The idea of using AI was one of the important motivators to go digital in the first place.
Why don't you talk a little bit more about that journey in from, let's call it, academic to commercialization of these data sets? Sure. And these models?
Sure. So my co-founder, Thomas Fuchs, was the AI scientist on the team. And, you know, when he joined MSK, he started experimenting with ways to predict pathologic diagnoses directly from the slides using AI. And, you know, we started with a rather crude technique of having individual cancer elements annotated on the digital images by pathologists and pathology fellows. And then he and his lab developed a novel technique that enabled the training without that sort of image annotation. And it became clear that the computer could recognize these patterns sufficiently well to find cancer. So this was an exciting finding. It worked for prostate cancer, which was one of the first use cases that we explored. It also worked for finding metastases from breast cancer and lymph nodes, or from finding a common type of skin cancer. And you know, as I mentioned, we really wanted to see if this could be used for patients. And in order to do that, it was clear that this had to be so-called productized. It had to be made into a way that would work in any environment, with any system, with any kind of scanner, and, you know, ought to have regulatory approval, which we subsequently obtained from the FDA. And so we really knew that in order to do this, we had to get resources beyond what you would have available in an academic setting.
And a lot of our listeners, you know, they're hearing these days, AI this, AI that. What, in this context, what is the difference between artificial intelligence and just other computational techniques that were already being used? Is it about the annotation, having a physician there actually doing the annotation versus the model being able to learn those skills itself?
Yeah, Joe, that's a great question. And, you know, I've asked my co-founder many times about defining artificial intelligence. It turns into a 45-minute conversation. But I think you hit the nail on the head. What we're doing here is we're providing the computer image examples of a diagnosis in sufficient quantity and with sufficient array of variation to enable the computer to learn to recognize it automatically. And I think that that actual learning process is what we refer to as artificial intelligence, that that based on this training, you can provide, for example, an image of a prostate biopsy, and the computer will, with a very high degree of accuracy, tell you whether there's cancer in there. It'll show you where the cancer is so you can verify that that's correct. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
And Dr. Klimstra, I think to set the stage for the next part of our conversation here, it might be helpful if you would quickly explain what Paige AI is. I said it a little bit in the introduction, but what is Paige AI? What are you doing? What are your main products? What is your overall suite of products?
Okay. Yeah, I can do that. So Paige, it's actually an acronym. It stands for Pathology Artificial Intelligence Guidance Engine. And it's a combination of products, which includes a platform to view the digital images. So as I alluded to, there are different types of scanners from different vendors. Each of them has, for instance, a different file format for their images. So we have a platform that will enable you to take those images from the scanner and view them on a computer monitor, manipulate them like you would a glass slide, and a lot of other features as well. But it's also the platform from which the AI is activated. And so in a fully digital workflow, the slide is scanned on whatever scanner you choose. We take the image and it goes into the cloud. It's then displayed in our viewing platform. You can look at it. And if there's AI available for that particular type of case, the AI will already have run in the cloud and you can see the results of the AI within the platform. So in addition to the platform, we have AI modules, which are specific diagnostic tools. Each one of these requires separate development and validation, approval, regulatory approval. And so the first that we released was a prostate cancer detection algorithm, Paige Prostate. But it now has other features as well. It will identify where the cancer is, measure it, and give it a Gleason grade, which is the standard pathologic assessment of aggressiveness based on histology. It'll find other important features like perineural invasion, et cetera. And so we have actually a suite of products to help with prostate biopsies. We have a breast suite, which includes a cancer detection component. It also includes a product to look for lymph node metastases. That's a very labor-intensive and time-consuming task for pathologists. And then in addition to diagnostic algorithms, we offer biomarker algorithms. And by this, I mean we produce an algorithm that predicts something from that pathology slide that's of importance for patient care. So it could predict, for instance, a genomic alteration that you would otherwise have to wait 3 weeks for tumor sequencing to obtain. We have something that predicts HER2 status for breast cancer from a routinely stained slide. We have another for colon cancer that will tell you if there's a microsatellite instability, which is very important for familial cancer and immunotherapy. I could mention, a half a dozen others that are in various stages of development at this point, but you get the sense of these AI products running the gamut from what we call decision support to help pathologists be more reproducible, accurate, efficient, to biomarkers that predict some other element of that tumor, be it a genomic alteration or an outcome.
Thank you for that description. Interesting to learn what the name stands for as well. I was wondering if it was an acronym. I also was getting medieval vibes. I thought maybe it was, a page, like an assistant.
sort of like having a digital fellow, we've referred to it. But it was also, you know that we ask Alexa or we ask Siri questions. So we thought, well, we should be able to ask someone a pathology question so we can ask Paige.
Absolutely. Well, my company also is an acronym, ORVA, stands for Orthopedic Virtual Assistant.
There you go.
We're kind of in the same mindset there. Now, I'm curious, both in your days at Memorial Sloan Kettering and now at Page AI, and as you're looking out at the landscape, at the market, what are the main hurdles that you're seeing in terms of adoption? Is the industry ready to adopt this technology? Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the challenges?
Yeah, this comes back to what we first started talking about, which is the pace of digital adoption. So if you're going to use AI in your routine practice, you really have to be fully digital, or at least whatever segment you want to apply AI to. So for instance, if you only want to use prostate AI, I guess you only have to be digital for prostate biopsies. But, you know, as more and more algorithms become available, it would help if the entire practice was digital. And there's a huge financial barrier, an operational barrier, an adoption barrier to digital pathology that remains. And so I think that remains the number one impediment to seeing this in widespread application throughout practice. There are other issues. Regulatory clearance is an issue, of course, and we're the only company that has taken a product successfully through the FDA for AI and pathology. But it is a pretty heavy lift. And if the FDA proceeds to require their assessment of all laboratory developed tests, that would really mandate that any of these products be reviewed by FDA, which is, you know, a significant amount of effort. And then finally, there's at present time, there's no reimbursement for diagnostic AI or for digital pathology. And so, practices thinking about going digital are always confronted with this upfront cost. And then, you know, the hope that they will recoup their return on investment based on efficiencies and other things, but there's no actual billing associated with it.
Interesting. I didn't know that about the billing. I was curious from the business standpoint, was it volume that made you choose breast and prostate cancers first, or what was the rationale there?
Yeah, very close to it. I mean, prostate is a special case. Most prostate biopsies generate anywhere from 12 to even more than 20 individual cores of tissue. And a number of years ago, pathologists were basically billing each one of those as a separate biopsy because they report separately for each of them. And CMS decided that wasn't really right, that you should get paid for, 15 separate biopsy codes. So they created a special billing code for a prostate biopsy series that really almost doesn't cover the costs involved in reviewing them. And so, to put it bluntly, some pathologists would say I lose money every time I read a prostate biopsy because the reimbursement is not sufficient. So we thought, well, here's an area where some efficiency could actually have an impact. And it is a high volume specimen. Same with breasts. I think there are challenges in breast pathology that, you know, having some AI assistance can be very helpful with. And it is a very, high volume practice.
For the listeners who don't know, most probably do, but in your last answer, CMS stands for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Very important on the billing front.
Yes.
One of the areas I saw you speaking about in an interview was mitosis and mitosis detection in pathology. Now, as a layman, in my basic state of mind, think of cancer as the rapid division of cells. And my understanding is that that's essentially what we're talking about with mitosis. How have these AI models performed, and have they impressed you versus I mean, you have so many years doing this yourself.
Yes. Counting things, there are not too many pathologists who will tell you that their favorite thing to do is count stuff. I don't know why. We don't like it. So anytime you're in a scenario where you have to look microscopically for, you know, potentially rather sparse structures and quantify them, we're neither happy to do it, nor are we particularly good at it. But it's very important for quite a number of breast cancer is a good example, but there are many other tumor systems where the number of mitoses in the tumor is quite important in terms of predicting how aggressive it is. In general, the more mitoses you have, the faster growing the tumor is, the more aggressive it is. And so some grading systems rely quite a bit on this. And so we trained an AI algorithm to detect mitoses and to quantify them in a unit of area, which is how they're generally reported. We used to use high power microscopic fields as the unit of area, but there's some variability depending on which microscope you use. Well, in the digital environment, you can literally calculate the square millimeters very precisely in a region of tumor. And then when you've detected the mitoses, you can determine exactly how many mitoses there are in that region. It also enables you to automatically find the most densely proliferative area in the cancer, which is what you're supposed to do, but it's hard to do without AI assistance. So this is an example of, you know, a technology that is very efficient. I mean, the output is instantaneous. It's a labor saver, but it's also something I think pathologists will really enjoy using because it's not a task they enjoy doing in the first place.
And that leads into my next question, replacing tasks that people don't like doing in the first place. Have you gotten any pushback? It's really in across all industries, the prevailing narrative about artificial intelligence is that it's going to put people out of jobs. What are those conversations like when you are speaking with other pathologists outside of Paige AI? Is that a real fear that they have? Is there an excitement about getting better assistance? What's kind of the general mood right now?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. There is a concern, shall we call it, that, you know, gee, if AI can do this, what do they need me for? But, you know, in honesty, well, 2 points to make. One is that the United States is facing a 25% deficit of pathologists. Very few medical students go into pathology as a discipline, and it's not growing by any stretch. Yet the tasks that confront pathologists are, you know, exponentially greater than they were 30 years ago when I started my career. And so there's a lot more work to be done, a lot more data to be analyzed, and not as many people to do it. So, you know, I think that the simple fact is that taking away some of the less, shall we call them, intellectual aspects of the job is a good thing. It enables pathologists to focus on the truly impactful determinations that they're making, rather than spending time, you know, just rote counting things or measuring things or screening through slides that are benign and the possibility there's a 1% chance there could be something in there. I mean, AI can do all those things and free a pathologist for more important tasks. But the other point is that the output of AI is not perfect. It never will be. There are so many variations in pathology that even models trained on, you know, tens of thousands of slides haven't seen everything. And so at the end of the day, I mean, a pathologist still has to verify the AI output. So it can make them more efficient by drawing their attention to an important feature. It can make them more confident by verifying you don't see anything on this slide and neither does the AI. But at the end of the day, it's the pathologist who has to establish the final diagnosis. The pathologist still has to look at the images. And so it's going to enhance their practice and make them more efficient, but it's not going to take their jobs.
Well, wouldn't it be interesting in kind of a paradoxical way if AI helped make up for the deficit pathologist and at the same time attracted more people to get into the field because of the excitement around AI.
I think that would be fantastic. And by the way, I mean, you know, when we talked a little about AI biomarkers, this offers an opportunity for pathologists to, get information from their routine slides that they cannot do today. Right. Sometimes they can do it based on sending tissue out for sophisticated testing that may be in another laboratory or even in a commercial lab outside of their practice. And sometimes there's simply no way to get this information to predict response to a drug for which we don't have a good test today. And by putting these tools in the hands of pathologists, we're empowering them to produce more impactful diagnoses that really not only document whether cancer is present, but tell you a lot more about it in terms of how it's going to behave, how it might respond to different kinds of treatment, et cetera.
So not only getting broader, but also more personalized or precision medicine, personalized medicine, as people say. So treating yes. people at a very individual level.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the major motivators for me to get involved in this, is the idea that we could learn things from tissue sections that really would enable us to offer much more profoundly impactful treatment to the individual patient. And so that's what we hope will happen. And as you said, we'll also make this field even more exciting than it was originally.
Well, I want to get to talking a little bit more about the business, but before I do, you know, there are only so many questions that I know to ask about what impacts this technology can have in pathology. We talked about mitosis. Are there anything else that stands out to you that you really would like to hit on before we move on?
Sure. A couple of things. I think one thing we haven't talked about is the potential that pathology AI could be essentially merged with other types of data, other types of AI, so that, you know, a prediction that we can make from pathology data, which may be pretty good, could be even better if it's enhanced based on AI applied to the radiographic imaging, PET scans, for instance, or some of these functional imaging scans. Maybe there are data coming from laboratory medicine testing, from serological studies, some other techniques that we already do, including molecular sequencing and immunohistochemistry, where we label proteins. All these produce data. And so, you know, the idea that you can combine these diverse data and derive a much more powerful predictor is very appealing. And it's an area of intense research. So I think that's one thing I'd just like to highlight. And the other point I want to make is, you know, when it comes to biomarkers, they're sort of two different kinds. There's a biomarker that exists, but it's expensive. It takes a long time. It uses up a lot of the tissue. It may not be available in under-resourced areas that we can do from a simple, routinely stained slide. It's a wonderful opportunity to derive that data from the slide, but at the end of the day, you can also verify it based on the existing technology. On the other hand, you have biomarkers that predict something that no one can predict with any technology today. And this would be, for instance, we want to predict the likelihood that a tumor will respond to immunotherapy. There's some biomarkers for that, but they're not very good. And if we have a really good one, there wouldn't be any way to verify it other than doing a clinical trial and showing that our AI biomarker works. And this, I think, is a very fundamental distinction between sort of verifiable AI output and novel AI output.
And when you said stained slides there, were you talking about immunohistochemistry? That's something that I was trying to learn a little bit more about before our call when I was looking at your other interviews and bios. I'm still not sure that I completely understand it. But is that what you're referring to there when you say stained slides?
Well, I mean, the routine stain that we use for every slide is a hematoxylin, an eosin, or H&E. Immunohistochemistry has a huge role in pathology today because it allows us to identify specific proteins in the tissue and in the context of the morphology. So they're both, I would say they're both routine stains. But when I say about routine stain slide, I mean the H&E, what we do in every single slide when we diagnose a tissue.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that explanation. Getting back into the business, when you and your colleagues, well, why don't you just tell us the story a little bit about how you and your colleagues came up with the idea for Page AI? Was it something that evolved over time? Was there kind of an aha moment?
Yes, I think so. I mean, we worked with, we had a business partner, Norman Selby, who had experience in the business arena and in the healthcare technology arena, who learned what we were working on and helped us with the process we would need to go through to raise money and understand how to build a business. This was certainly new to me. I mean, I had been in an academic practice for my entire career. But you know, between the three of us, we covered the medical side, the AI side, the business side, and we're fortunate enough to attract a group of investors that saw the vision that we saw and believed that this would be a useful product that people would ultimately pay for. Obviously, an important aspect of building a business, that's how it moved forward. We had support from Memorial Sloan Kettering as well, with their business development group. And, we're fortunate enough to get the investment to allow us to spin this out after, a period of work in the academic arena.
Is your day-to-day at Page similar to your day-to-day at Memorial Sloan Kettering, or two totally different worlds?
Oh, it's a totally different world. Yeah. At Memorial Sloan Kettering, I had a rather diverse practice, which included a lot of administrative work, but also teaching and my own research and collaborative research and diagnostic work and consultations and many different things. Certainly nothing on the business side. Page still has a research component to it in the sense that we do studies both to develop new algorithms and test the ones we have, but also to validate that in clinical practice, this is truly useful and that people find it helpful both for efficiency and accuracy. But, there are a lot of other aspects to working in the business environment that were quite unfamiliar to me when I started.
Off the top of your head, can you think of anything that you enjoy more in the world of business or less, in either situation, whether it was in an academic setting or in a business setting, things that are just different that you either enjoy or dislike?
Well, I think when you work in a complex organization like Memorial Sloan Kettering, I mean, there are a lot of competing priorities, right? And something that I might think is really important for my department, an initiative that I want to pursue may not actually be important enough in the context of everything else going on to get funded or to get supported. When you're working for a company, pretty much everybody is motivated in the same direction. There could be some disagreements about, what would make the most effective product or, exactly where to put our resources, but we're all sort of focused on building the same thing. So I think that's a benefit to working in a company, or at least in a small company. Another point, and this is just sort of the chronic pathologist's grumpiness that we're the physicians behind the curtain. The other physicians don't fully understand what we do, and the patients don't even know we exist. And so you're always in the position of having to try to help people understand why pathology is important. If you work for a pathology company, people get that very quickly, and they're all equally, devoted to pushing pathology forward. As you said, what's different? It's less positive. I guess the commercial focus has to be there, right? I mean, especially as you're starting out, you can't really afford to do research for the sake of knowledge. So interesting ideas that don't necessarily have a clear market justification really can't get done by a startup, especially. And that's different, right? I mean, research in an academic environment is based on recognizing that there's a knowledge gap and trying to conduct studies to fill it, whether or not somebody is going to pay for it at the end of the day. And that's a mindset that was a difficult one for me to adopt.
For Page AI, you're probably familiar with the Amazon story, but to remind readers, Amazon started only selling books, but that was never the ultimate goal. From day one, the goal was to become the quote-unquote everything store. But they started with books because there's a tremendous number of titles, it's high volume, and a few other factors, and they wanted to prove that playbook. And once they proved that playbook, they could get into other verticals. Is that kind of how you are thinking about it at Page AI, meaning are breast cancer and prostate your books, so to speak?
I guess so. I mean, I think it could go beyond that, actually. I mean, our books in that sense are you know, we're those are the initial products. There's a litany of other products that, you know, we could create, and we are creating, but those are all sort of other types of books in a way. I think if I were to take your analogy, I would say that the area to go beyond is beyond pathology. It's to take advantage of that multimodal data that I mentioned, getting data related to other areas of medical diagnostics, and merging that and trying to build AI for computer vision broadly within the field of medical diagnostics. And so that would probably be the more appropriate analogy. You know, that's aspirational. I think you have to focus when you're getting started and show that you can do it in the area that you're most devoted to. But if I were to envision where this could go, yes, very clearly bringing in data from all sorts of other sources to enhance the predictive power of the things that we have in pathology would be a very logical next step.
So in your career, you have this vast experience in pathology, but now you also have deep expertise, at least as it relates to a healthcare professional, in artificial intelligence. Do you think that all physicians should be kind of thinking through that lens? Do you think everyone needs to understand this technology at a much deeper level these days?
Well, I think people have to be prepared for it. I mean, AI is everywhere now. We're all using it, whether we know it or not. And it's certainly coming into healthcare in many different ways, from natural language processing to, you know, image-based AI like we're talking about today. Does that mean that everybody needs to know how to build algorithms? No. In fact, I don't know how to build algorithms. I'm not an AI scientist. I think what it means is that you have to gain enough familiarity with what they can do and what they can't do. You have to learn how to assess them and decide, is this something that I can use and it can be productive for me? You have to learn how to avoid AI bias so that you don't overly rely on the output of the AI if it goes against your better judgment. And this is a risk if you aren't, you know, thoughtful about how it's used. So I think that what's important is that people are, you know, not to be afraid of it, but rather to embrace the possibility that it can be helpful, and then, you know, take advantage of the tools that are available to build an experience so that you can make your own judgments about how this is going to help your practice. That I think is going to be necessary. And I don't think it's reasonable to say, you know what, AI, that's just not for me. I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to do what I do, because this field is evolving so rapidly.
You touched on biases there that reminded me. I wanted to ask you, how do you, well, both at Page AI, but also more generally in the industry, how is and should patient privacy be protected? In this case, is it as simple as anonymizing the slides?
Yes, the short answer is yes, it could be. But if you're using digital pathology for diagnostic purposes, then it's actually critical that the images be identified, right? So the pathologist knows which case they're looking at, which patient they're looking at. But there have to be firewalls to prevent that information from escaping from the environment in which it's contained. You know, at Page, we've gone through considerable lengths to ensure that all of our cloud storage is secure and that there's, you know, no patient identification breaches. The images we use for training and validation are all completely anonymized. We never see any patient identification at Page. But yeah, this is a critical point that when you're in any digital environment, right? Anytime you create digital data, it makes it easier to transfer, and therefore the need for safeguards is even greater.
Oh yes, to clarify, I was referring specifically to in the training sets.
Yeah, in the training set. Yeah, we actually built a program. It also has an acronym, which is HOBIT. I have to remember what it stands for. Honest Broker for Bioinformatic Technology, which isn't exactly what it is, but it fits HOBIT. And this was designed to ensure that not only were there no labels associated with the images that contain the patient identifying information, but that there was nothing else on the slide that was scanned that could conceivably tie it back to the patient. And so every image that comes to Page is scanned by this program to ensure that everything is completely anonymous.
Got it. Okay. And to wrap up here, you know, Page AI looks like it's in a great place. Very impressive team, incredible investors, I believe, including KKR and Johnson & Johnson. It looks like you've raised several hundred million dollars. You probably know the exact figure if you'd like to share it. And just to wrap up here, you know, what's next for Page AI? What's on the horizon?
Right. Well, yes, we've raised I think $220 million, which is a nice start. You know, I think what's next for Page is to continue to work with a variety of different organizations that are seeking to push the adoption of digital pathology. This remains an important aspect of getting our products into the marketplace and ensuring that you know, pathologists and therefore their patients have access to this technology. Creating more impactful biomarker assays is also a very important priority for us. That these are a little trickier to build than a simple decision support algorithm. And because cancer care evolves so quickly, some of the things that we thought were going to be very impactful in terms of predicting response to a drug have actually changed in front of our eyes as we work through this. So, you know, building more of these, I think, is a very important priority, and building partnerships. We have an open platform, so anyone's AI can run on our platform. And so we're building partnerships with other AI companies to create an environment where pathologists can get access to any of the tools that they want in order to enhance their practice.
Just to clarify there, are you saying that there's an open source model of it, or what do you mean when you say that someone can build on top of it?
Well, not that it's open source, but in order to run the AI, you have to deploy it on a viewing platform.
Right. And
so we deploy our algorithms on our viewing platform, which is called Full Focus. I don't think I mentioned that. But we can also deploy anyone else's AI, including if an academic institution has built their own. We can deploy that for them, or we can deploy AI from any other vendor on our platform. So it provides them a single place where they can go view their images and then run AI, any type of AI they wish.
Got it. Well, Dr. Klimstra, I appreciate you joining me today on the Medical AI Podcast. We wish you and your team at Page AI all the best and hope you will join us again another time.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for listening. This has been the Medical AI Podcast. We are Felix Beecher and Joe McKeating. Ping us on LinkedIn if you have any ideas on new guests. See you next time.